Live from the Retro Dome Theater in San Jose, California, this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Yay.
Please welcome two men who have been described as podcast royalty. They are the most interesting podcasters in the world, Mr. Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Yep. I'm Dean Haglund. Normally, we're coming to you live from our offices at the heart of the historic core of Los Angeles, but today, here we are, after screening our U.S. premiere of The Truth Is Out There. And of course, as always, I'm with my co-host, raconteur, Mr. Noofity Noof, Ocho Cinco.
Nobody knows what that means.
If you listen to our show,
there's nothing better than that's true.
Right?
Right. So but that's not going to encourage people to listen to the show. I am Phil Lernes, and we did a great podcast show today. We were guests on Mark Hirschhorn's Succotash show.
Yes.
Which is a great podcast that is all about comedy podcasts, and it gives clips of comedy podcasts that Mark believes might be worth your time and attention. And he made our collective heads snap back. Collective heads?
Collective heads.
I don't know. Because yes, we had them sitting there.
Another one. And then, a third head snapped.
He described us as podcasting royalty. And,
yes.
And, I mean, we're good. Don't kid yourself.
But royalty?
And I guess the one of the reasons behind it was that we just had our four-year anniversary show. We have done...
Yes.
4 years, every week, never missed a single week.
Yeah, even when we're out of town, we will pre-record a show, pretending as if we're there, and then somebody will blow it.
That would be me.
You always lie.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes we, of course, take our equipment on the road and do shows wherever we are,
yeah.
Like today for the U.S. premiere of The Truth Is Out There. One of the reasons, Dean Haglund,
yes,
that we had the first screening of the finished film on American soil in this theater is that this is the very first place I ever saw a movie when I was a child.
Is that true? Do you remember what it was?
It was a movie about a football-playing mule.
Oh!
Called Gus.
Gus!
And I spent virtually the whole time, as I've told you before, with my back to the screen, peeking out over my chair, watching the people and how the light played on their faces.
Where were you sitting?
I was staring at the projection booth because that seemed, remember, your first movie. You have no idea, right?
And, I would think I'd want to watch the first movie.
You know what? It was many years before I actually got into movies. What I actually dug was the magic that was going on up there. Like, how did this series of flickering images become continuous motion on the screen? How could... Seriously,
That's a twisted childhood thing, isn't it?
How could the projector be black? How could the shutter be closed for two-thirds of the time, and yet up on screen, there was an image there the whole time? Literally, I realized as a child when you're watching a 90-minute movie that you're only seeing 30 minutes of images, that 60 minutes of the time the screen is black. And so it occurred to me that, boy, how we walk through the world seeing things might not actually be how they are, that perception is the key. And I started to learn here in the Retro Dome, and I think those are some of the themes explored in The Truth Is Out There. Now, if you would like
to speak,
I'm doing my imitation of Alex Jones.
Yes, exactly.
If you want to speak, just go ahead and speak.
We're going to break now. What? No, what happened? What happened? I had something. No, the term you're looking for is persistence of vision. That's how we could see a 30 minutes of image in a 90-minute movie. Because the eye has a persistence and it doesn't go as fast as...
You know, I still have a great deal of hearing loss in this ear. So next time, maybe you should sit on the other side if you with those gems.
Oh, you bastard. You don't...
My heterosexual life partner, Dean Haglund.
Yes, Phil, it's 4 years of this.
You know what else I saw here?
What? Did you ever see Gus again, though? Did you ever see the movie Frontways?
It's about a football-playing mule.
I know.
What am I going to... Why am I...
Are you kidding? The mule comes on to save the winning goal, and they look in the rule book to see if a mule is allowed, and it says nothing, so the mule is allowed to kick that field goal. Huh?
Spoiler alert!
Oh, yes. Sorry. For all of you who missed Gus, I forgot to mention.
For those of you who do listen to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, Dean, one of his monikers is Kid Spoiler.
Yes.
Because he...
I spoil everything.
And he always then, after he's done it, says spoiler alert. Well, if somehow that will make up for it. Now, Lily Holloman, our mistress of ceremonies, has a wireless mic. So if anyone gets her attention, if they have a question, get her attention and she'll come over to you and prepare... To
question about the movie you just saw or
about
anything at all.
About anything, about my thank you mood t-shirt inspired by Tim Gunn. And while she's doing that, I will tell you about another story of a movie that I saw here on the 1 year anniversary of Raiders of the Lost Ark being in theaters.
Yes.
Remember back then when movies played
for a whole year?
Like a year.
I know Arthur. How many years was that?
It's still in theaters.
Yeah. No, that's a new one.
Oh.
That's a different Arthur.
Right.
Yeah, that's not that
one. I on the 1 year anniversary, my sister and I took my dad, who hadn't seen it, we took him to see it, and during the truck chase, it's a big crowd, even though it was in for a year, it was still a big crowd on a weekend day. My dad, during the truck chase sequence, very loudly just lets out some, "This is so unrealistic," and gets up and walks out, like destroys the truck chase sequence for all these people. And my sister is so humiliated. And of course, I'm just laughing my ass off. Like, you know, I'm sorry you didn't get the History Channel documentary about the Ark of the Covenant you were looking for. Have you ever heard of a movie? But for years thereafter, that was always my pet criticism. It's so unrealistic.
Right, because the whip under the drive chain, surely that would have yanked his arm off.
Women find Prince attractive. It's so unrealistic. My favorite science fiction film, of course.
Right.
Purple Rain. Okay.
Okay, good.
So we have a question.
Is there a question?
We do.
Yes.
I was just wondering if Lyle had the object in his arm removed, and was it an alien implant?
Oh, that is a good question.
I love that you asked the one question that probably could have been best answered in the lobby.
Yes, when Lyle was there.
Neither of us have ever asked, so why don't you give your answer and then I'll...
The answer is no. I don't think he's had it removed. No. He had it looked at. It seems like it's potentially it could be an implant. I discussed with him what happened in 1981. He doesn't really remember, but it has been there ever since. And I think Dr. Roger Lear is starting to charge a little more for removing alien implants because there's a longer lineup now of people that have stuff. And often he'll just remove a twig or something and then, you know, and then he'll send it away for $21,000 worth of analysis and it'll come back. It's a twig. Yeah, So that cost him a lot of money. But
Real answer is that it's a diamond that was inserted in there when he was a gambler back in Cuba before the fall. It's true. True story.
I find that hard to believe. That's unrealistic. That's like Raiders of the Lost Ark unrealistic. That's unbelievable. Anyway, so yeah, good question. Of course... I suppose we should...
We should ask him.
We should ask
him. Maybe that'll be in the sequel.
Well, that's a sequel. When we'll do that, it'll just be Lyle's arm in the bonus feature. That'd be fantastic.
I don't see any other questions.
Is that all the questions we had?
Oh, we do have one down here.
Down front. Yes, we have a wireless microphone that can go anywhere.
So just get her attention at any point, because right now this whole part is just... This is aces for our listening audience around the world. Steve Turner with a question.
Yes.
Stand-up comic.
So you got to talk to some interesting folks.
Yes.
None more so than right now.
Well, thank you, Phil. We'll spoon later.
Spoon, then fork.
Yes, exactly.
Weird. Yeah. I weirded out.
Then, of course. when watching this, I had to sort of suspend my...
disbelief.
I'm a scientist by training, so I realized that... A lot of the folks I was going to be seeing in this movie, I have a predisposition to disbelief.
Right. Sure.
And so I tried as best as I could to sort of wipe that away. So the question I was going to ask you is that of the people that you talked to, who were sort of the most surprising, the most opposite of what you expected, and who ended up being exactly what you expected? I have a prediction on who that
was. Wow. You know, I know some of the, like Jordan Maxwell and Dr. Lear and stuff like that. I've seen at many conventions and known for a long time. So naturally, They were what I expected. Though, I'll take that back. Jordan Maxwell actually was a bit surprising because there was two different times we interviewed him, one in Laughlin and one at the other convention. And he was sort of two different
people.
Two different people, the way he was in one. And it was like kind of light and jovial. And then the Laughlin, Nevada, I was like, you will never know. We have screwed it. We had 6,000 years and we're doomed. It's like, what happened to that happy guy that we were talking to? So that was so that was surprising. Everybody was surprising, actually, now that I think about it. Even David Sirita with his, I want to not pay my taxes and get in a UFO and get out of here. It's like, really? That's all the basis of all your work is just to get out? Like, all of it was, like, surprising to me.
Now
that I think about it.
Lyle did a great deal of research for this, especially originally when we had certain conspiracies. We thought at one point we were going to count down Dean Haglund's 10 favorite conspiracy theories, and that's how we were going to go into this. And very quickly, once we started investigating one, it became very clear that the road was being laid out for us, that one person led to the next person. And even though, you know, in this odd way, that might be about totally different subjects, there clearly was a path that was being laid out. So we abandoned that. But Lyle did a great deal of the research in the beginning, and I intentionally did not avail myself of that research. I did not want to know what people were going to be saying. I asked Lyle to give me notes. What do we need to know that we hit? But I wanted to not be in the position that you had to be in, which was forcing myself to suspend my predisposition. I wanted to be able to find, because what I'm interested in are the people that are telling the stories more than, you know, I see them as much more than the sum of the information that they're offering. And I wanted to try to be able to capture the person as I was seeing them. And so I really came to it very tabula rasa. I mean, very, you know, open book about all these people,
that's,
right? Clean slate.
Yeah, right.
Right. I think it's Latin. Anybody?
No. Spanish?
Okay. So, point to Lernes?
No. Point to Lernes. Damn it.
But I would say that I found, so even though I didn't have predispositions, I would constantly be surprised within conversations at people's ability to pull themselves into rabbit holes of their own making and to reclaim themselves once they've dragged themselves down into those rabbit holes, all within the same conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And what became very apparent to me very early on in it was that I knew some people would come because they were big fans of, you know, certain experts, and I knew that for the most part they would see surprising sides to these people that they'd never been allowed to see before. And at the same time, I knew that there would be people that people might never have seen before that it would be very easy to judge from the outset. You know, when you lead with, I'm an alien-human hybrid.
Yes, that's a surprise.
You're asking for maybe, dare we say, a little bit of judgment.
Right.
Not from you.
I run into that quite...
You actually believed her, and why not?
Why not?
What does it cost us to believe someone?
Right.
Right? I mean, we don't have to live our lives based on whether or not we think someone else is an alien human hybrid.
Right, exactly.
Right? Unless maybe we're sharing a bed with them. But the thing is...
Did not happen. I got to point that out. Did not happen.
But honestly, this will be maybe the most surprising thing about me. Of anyone we met, though, if I had pets and I was going to leave town and needed any of these experts to watch them for me while I was gone, it would be the alien-human hybrid one.
Yes.
Because no one we met was more loving, was more kind, had a more generous, healing energy about her. And so, you know, if whatever the narrative was that it was required for her to get to that place of loving kindness to not only herself but everyone around her, well, then fly me into the sun, mad Ferengi woman, because I want to live in your world.
Exactly. It's fabulous. So true.
One of the things that's been really rewarding is that people who are really up on many of these theories have said that we did a very good job of showing sides of them that they hadn't been able to see before. That,
true.
That with only a couple of exceptions, there are a couple of people maybe where you get exactly what you're expecting of them.
Yeah. Oh, who's Steve? Radio douche. I think that's my code name.
Yeah. How did they get? How did? Wait a minute.
I'm radio
Wasn't
douche.
That Dan Quayle's Secret Service name? I don't understand.
If you're referring to Alex Jones, perhaps is that the guy? Radio douche. I didn't. I've never heard him called that.
I would say two things about Alex Jones, and I am not. You're friends with Alex Jones, so let me address this one. Just that I didn't know Alex either personally or really. Even by reputation or his work. And there were two things. One thing that does not come through in the film, but it does in one of the bonus features on both the two disc collector's edition and the Blu-ray that are available. is he was so generous with us and so gracious and such a wonderful host, even though it seems like he's being a terrible host because he's walking all over. He gave over his entire show saying, you know what we want to do? We want to come on your show and interview you for our documentary. And he let us do that.
In his hour, yeah.
And so there was that. And the other thing that I would just observe is that there is obviously a showman in him. And yeah. And I found him to be, just one-on-one, I found him to be, quite... You know,
good guy.
Quite a good guy.
Yeah. But his persona can be, he gets emotional, shall we say. And so when he gets on those rants, I think they're fantastic. Even if you're in the room with it, it's very frightening. That's a lot of energy coming at you all at once. And so, and you don't want to jump in because he's going to come out with some bon mot that's going to be awesome. So you don't want to go, hey, wait, Alex, before you go with that plot. I don't do that. I just sort of let him go till he goes, oh, we're at break.
And I appreciate you really doing what is kind of hard work, which is, you know, freeing ourselves of the predisposition, because it is such human nature, especially in an era where we are inundated with this information so much. As Dean described, being in this information blizzard, I think we all feel that at some points. And it's almost survival mechanism to say, okay, I don't have to listen to that guy because I know that he's radio douche or whatever it is.
Right.
However, all of us are going to be wrong as often as we're right about anything. And the more we can open ourselves up to at least listening to people, even the people, maybe especially the people we're predisposed to disagreeing with, the more information we're allowing ourselves to have access to that could serve us in some way, in some sort of
tangent that you wouldn't even expect. Exactly.
Yes.
And that they connect, like the movie does. Like, there are all these different interviews towards the end. They all start drawing lines amongst each other that you would never suspect. We didn't go out of our way to go, hey, let's get that guy and my nephew, and they're all going to say the same thing. Won't that be cool? Like, that just all...
No, we'd never heard of ayahuasca, and boy, that's going to be an even bigger part of the sequel.
Yes, exactly. We're all high in ayahuasca.
48 hours of me shooting Dean through a really bad trip.
I'm in a cloud. I don't know. I don't know what the heck.
Oh,
I
think
question.
The lovely and talented Mark Hirshon has a question.
Yes, Mark, just curious, were there any favorite chunks you had to lose because of time or the way you were putting the film together? They just didn't fit in?
My bath scene. No, there's no. Was there favorite chunks? Yeah. Yeah. No. Well, you did all the editing. I mean, I stepped away. I was too close to the forest. So I all my criticisms were, don't give that shot to it. I look like hell. And then that wasn't the point. So Phil then took it over.
Aside from the fact that there's over 80 minutes of bonus features available.
He gets four more of those in this hour.
I would say that I had to make a decision very early on that anything that really lent itself towards discussion of ancient wisdom or ancient mysteries needed to be its own piece, which is why at the end we promised the follow-up about ancient wisdom. So many of these conspiracies can and do find the origin of their narrative hundreds, even thousands of years ago. and there was no way to include it. So the decision was made, look, this all needs to go.
To the next movie.
So I wouldn't say that I regret cutting that out. I something that is not in either the bonus footage or the film right. that I do regret is a piece that I love. And it's Dean when he was speaking with Bruno Brewiler of We Are Change LA in Century City, or in Beverly Hills, with the Century City Twin Towers behind him. And we don't address that fact. You see the Twin Towers while they're talking about the Twin Towers. And what we cut out, and we're probably right to cut out, but it is a piece I love, is Dean telling the story about how those towers were designed by...
His name.
By the architect.
The architect.
Who did the World Trade Center.
What's his name again?
And I don't know, you got it so right off the top of your head in the movie.
Too bad you didn't keep it in.
Yeah, I guess. I'm really regretting it now. Yeah. So... anyway, it was designed by the same architect, and Dean recounted the fact that in Los Angeles, after the attack on 9/11, people refused to show up to work in those buildings because there was a true fear that what was happening was people were targeting the architect's work, that it was all about him.
Right.
Yeah.
So that because the Twin Towers and these two buildings in Beverly Hills were the same architect, that the next day the terrorists were going to hit every
piece of that
architect did. Like what? Like, yes, we're mad at the architecture. That's what's going to was the crazy. Yeah. That's a Beverly Hills thing.
Right.
Yeah. You can see why we didn't leave it in, I guess. Yeah. Any other questions? There's one. Yoshi.
I was wondering how, for better or for worse, the rapport you've established in the podcast, which I think had been going on for 2 years when you started, how that might have spilled over or affected the filmmaking process.
Oh, you mean the way we chat between us affected the hatred? How did that affect the filmmaking process? Well, you know, it's a lot of work to put a podcast together, so... We are both producers. So for me, there was a lot of ability to give up a lot of control because I can trust Phil to get stuff done, and he is more organized than I am, luckily. And what?
No.
Yeah,
I'm
you
not.
Agree? And and so...
I would agree. I'm more organized.
And so actually the podcast acted also as our production meetings, but also as a small model of producing a larger thing like a film. So for me, it actually freed me up a lot to concentrate on the interviews and all of that stuff and not have to worry about behind the scenes of what's going on with the camera and that sort of thing.
I think the more you have conversations, especially disagreements,
right.
with people who are your collaborators, it can only help build rapport if ego isn't part of the equation, and what we do on a weekly basis as we're arguing about things,
bickering like housewives,
bickering like old married couple, is for fun, and it certainly establishes a rapport that informs what we do in film. Of course, we'd been working together long before the podcast. Also, we just turned on microphones and started podcasting it when I think, one of our assistants just said, these Monday morning water cooler discussions, because we had offices next to each other, maybe those would be great for a podcast. And looking back, I think that was just a way of saying maybe you guys could go into one of your offices.
Yeah. Could you just shut the door and shut
What a
up?
Great idea. Yes. The whole world could
love. Must listen to this chatter. It's fascinating. Yeah, because it was true, because we worked on Spectres before. And people ask how we met. We don't even actually know for sure, because it was like, there was that show you came to. But then I ran into you at the theater after Star Wars.
Star Wars?
You saw the new episode 1 in digital or something.
We ran into each other at a theater. Right,
yeah.
after some movie.
But you
however,
already
Yeah,
knew.
No, but it was one of those things where truly, I remember I was casting a film. I was casting director on a film, and I wanted you to meet a director, and I came to your show. Dean still does occasionally, but back then...
It was a weekly.
It was a weekly show. Did a live improv show where he improvised an episode of The X-Files each week while The X-Files was on the air still.
Right.
And it's called Paranoia Will Destroy It.
Oh, yeah. Remember that?
And I brought a director to meet you,
yes.
our friend Alan Piper.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if you would remember me, and indeed you remembered me. And that is one of the extraordinary things I've witnessed with you traveling around the world, is you do always remember people. You may not always get the names right, but you're apt to get the convention right.
The convention right, and then more or less the geographical location.
I think the other thing, Yoshi, that really does coalesce in working on a podcast together that we then bring forward into the world is that, and people have said this in a really complimentary way, but it, what they're basically saying is that Dean and I form one fully functioning human being. And part of it is, and we know this, is, right, you are very friendly.
Yes.
And I'm kind.
Right, but not...
Never the twain shall meet.
Right.
You know, I'm not the most friendly guy.
He's an ass. But once he's friends with you, very kind.
And Dean is very friendly and...
But I don't return
not
emails.
Not organized enough
not
to
organized,
return emails.
You know, and then like friends go, hey, dude, it's been 9 months. In fact, a funny story. I'm in New York with my girlfriend, and we've been now living together 4 years. And she goes to get tickets at the Will Collier Theater. And I'm at a bar, and I see an actor friend of mine that I haven't seen since before her and I were living together. And it's like, hey, how are you? And we're like, we're having a drink. And she comes back and she goes, hey, who's this? I go, this is my best friend. And she goes, I've lived with you for 4 years. I've never heard of this guy. What do you mean, your best friend? No, that's how best friends we are. We don't see each other for 4 to 5 years. Is that bad? Yeah, it is. So I keep bad friendships. That, unless I'm in a podcast, then I see the guy every week.
Right.
Whether I want to or not.
Yeah, it's what you do for to maintain a friendship.
So there seems to be a running theme with all of these interesting people that you're interviewing, and that is that none of them seem to actually believe in the truth. They have this notion that, except their own truth, which of course is that all truth is subjective and relative. Mm-hmm. You know, these people are talking about like, oh, we're not, you know, we shouldn't judge, and there's, you know, and they're bad-mouthing all kinds of religions because they seem to think they have the corner on the truth. But yet, isn't that an opinion of their own? That, I mean, did you ever find the irony in that they're lambasting everybody else for thinking they got the corner on the truth when, in fact, that is a position that they have a corner on the truth, that right. Nobody has a corner on the truth.
And we actually asked that question a couple of times.
But did it? I don't remember the response in the film. Did they?
Well, I mean, Dr. Tiller sort of came, but he brought it back to being subjective.
Yeah.
So that there's the universal truth is that it's all subjective.
Which, of course, is an absolute truth.
Is there an absolute? But then
no. I'm saying to say that the universal truth is that it's all subjective is an absolute truth. So it's self-destruct. So I just think that what I loved about it is there's this irony that keeps being pointed out at person after person, and I don't know if that ever struck you as you guys were making the film.
Well, there is obviously to swim in the waters of consciousness is to swim in the same waters as schizophrenics, and one
what?
Must hold. It's Schrodinger's cat. One must hold
two truths simultaneously. Yeah.
And if you're going to go into those waters, you have to do this. And it always felt right to me that the artist, that the painter Lee McCloskey, is in the middle of the film. He's in the exact middle of the film, and he will, this painter, express these themes that later the Institute of Noetic Science and these physicists will be talking about on the frontiers of science, right? And he's just come to these truths through his painting, through his artwork. And I love the painting of, that he has on all the religion books, because he takes the counter opinion, not that, you know, all the religions are wrong or are failing us in some way. For him, it's they're all the answer, and that if you take away any one of them, you've eliminated the beauty of it. I like that he is literally creating a work that is all about saying yes to everything, that's how he manages to hold both possibilities. And then the other thing that he says, of course, is that it's not so much about, for him, subjective, so much as, look, if it works for you, who am I to question it?
Right.
If you are a good neighbor and a loving friend and a attentive mother, what does it matter to me if you're an alien human hybrid? What does it matter?
Right. I'm flying on that Ferengi ship into that sun.
And so, you know, there's moments like that that for me allow me not to get pulled into the sense of, okay, at all their points of view self-destruct, that, you know, I'm capable of taking the gems from all of it and building something meaningful for myself.
Right.
Look at that.
That's a smattering, an official smattering. Congratulations.
We have the definition.
We got a smattering. Yeah. That's so true. I think, did that answer the question? Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, we need an introduction. Yes.
This is the perfect time.
Beautiful singer, beautiful woman. My mother's favorite part of the movie, Gemma Bulos, who talks about water rights and about how the events of 9/11 inspired her to help others because she chose to see the world as coming together, is here with us. That's Gemma Bulos.
Please.
Well, totally an honor to be here on the end of days. I can't imagine spending it, you know, in any other scenario.
2 hours left.
Celebrating conspiracies. I was interested. I mean,
ladies and gentlemen, we have him here, Harold Camping. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Good night.
You know, if we're talking about how we all see the world and all of our, you know, different truths, one of the ways that I see the world is just sort of the differences between men and women, and just how they see the world. And what I thought was interesting, and maybe it's because that's how I choose to see it, is that when you interviewed the women, all the women had these theories about, you know, what was happening, but they were also doing something. I was wondering if there was I'm not trying to accuse the men of not doing anything. I'm just saying that did you just not ask them, or did they not offer it, or is that something that you didn't think was important to the theme of the movie?
We never asked really anyone. I mean, it was always
a conversation.
It was always, we would ask certain questions about the truth and
I would never, in fact, the notes I got, I never read. I would just talk. These would be conversations that we have, and then it would be up to Phil to.
And so I really tried to do an honest representation of how these people presented themselves.
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't mean that they're not doing something. Maybe they are very active in going out and changing things in a way other than being locked into their compounds hosting radio shows. which is several of the people,
yes.
Right? I mean, you know, they live in secret locations and they host radio shows, and maybe they are active in doing things in other ways. It is telling, though, that they never chose to discuss that.
Yeah.
That it was all about the information that they could offer.
Which is doing something, but yes, what you know and what you do are two separate things. And I'm just going through the movie now in my head going, I guess that's true, that all the men just offer... Not all of them.
No, your sister's boyfriend doesn't. He's all about doing, right? John.
Yes.
John is all about doing.
Right. He's with the horse loggers. I don't know if they actually clearly pointed out what the horses were teaching him, but they were environmental horse loggers. They go in the woods with those horses, selectively log wood, and then bring it out with the horses so as not to destroy all the flora and fauna, and that the forest can regenerate faster than driving a giant mechanized machine in there and tearing it all up. And so the horse that died, he gave back to the forest, to the wild, so that it'd be a complete regeneration. So.
And also, I think, in fairness, it isn't down straight down certainly gender lines. Again, getting back to Lee McCloskey, mm-hmm. who kind of echoes something that you say in the film, you know, because he chose to meet an act of violence or destruction with an act of creation. And I think that maybe there's more of a distinction there between the people who are creating versus the people who are critiquing.
That's a good one. Yeah, But that's funny that that's what you perceive to see, Jalen, because I never noticed that before. But now you said that, now I'm like thinking it the whole movie. Oh, now, yeah, all the women are doing stuff. And then it's like the guys are doing dick all.
Now, I know we actually had a question for Gemma. I have one, and maybe if this covers it, and you'll let me know. What is the latest with... Do 1 in 6 people in the world still not have access to fresh water? I mean, it's been 2 years. Have we fixed that yet?
We haven't fixed it, but according to whoever's taking the statistics, it went from 1.2 billion down to 884 million people. So there is improvement, and it's because there was a...
Because they died?
Well, yeah. they
you know, don't
up.
Think we're not on list because we want to actually do something about that. It's not Ethos water or Aquafina.
Aquafina water, no.
No, I'm kidding. But basically, there were some Millennium Development Goals that were established by the United Nations in 2005 to reach by 2015 to reduce the number of people who don't have access to water by half. So
how close are we to that?
Well, we're not. There are some countries who are on track. There are other countries who are just not, but...
Is that part of their scheme to create a global government run by the banks?
That I wouldn't be able to critique.
And is that why there's been more rain in California, that we're 5 inches above normal in our aquifer? Is that a government process too? Or?
Well, so that's interesting that you say that, because access is defined by 5 gallons of water per person per day and 1 kilometer from the water source. So if you're talking about climate change and flooding, and thinking about flooding, they could very well have water much closer to them.
In my basement.
In your basement, exactly.
Problem solved.
Right. Thank you, government.
Thank you, climate change.
Right. I can dream.
And what over the last, since we last saw you and spoke to you, have been some of the frustrations that you might have encountered in...
Well, I've since started focusing my work on women in water, because women are the ones who carry the biggest burden of lack of access to water. Not only do they...
Because they take such long showers. Am I right, guys?
I know, don't we? I know. We've got a lot more hair. So...
Oh my God. Thanks for rubbing that.
And we've got a shower, shampoo, shine, condition.
I appreciate that.
Bullet right to you.
Ixnay on there.
Aimed it right at you. There was no dodging that one.
I'm such a nice bounce card for you, though. This lighting is lovely.
I know.
I totally forgot the question.
Women.
Women. Okay, women and water.
More
right.
Water.
I've been focusing more on women and water because women are the most burdened. They're the ones who, in the developing countries, who actually end up having to fetch the water. So women and girls end up spending, in Africa, 40 billion hours a year just getting water. So.
Wow.
No school for girls, no economic opportunities for women. So, and it's always so interesting to me because I go to a lot of water conferences around the world. Some, the bigger.
And you do improv comedy.
And yes. I do improv comedy, and you should see me
show,
tap.
No.
Woo! So, and, there's always a section where everyone talks about having to include the women in the conversation, having them to be part of the decision-making, yet you look out into the audience and all you see are men. Mm. So part of the work that I'm trying to do is just build the capacity of women to actually have a better voice and have them included in the decision-making around water and sanitation solutions.
Right, and are you then starting the teaching program too, to teach more of the women to access water and water?
Yep, that's what we do. We train women in what we call appropriate technologies, and appropriate technologies basically are, their criteria is basically that they're affordable, you can access all the materials locally, people can build it, and they can actually maintain it on their own.
Right.
So they're not dependent on any kind of outside sources. So, and of course that it's accepted by the community. So we teach the women how to do that. We give them, sort of strategies on how to make it a little bit more sustainable in terms of income generation, and to make sure that they're not only just implementing or providing any kind of clean water or sanitation solutions, but that they actually can even educate and get people and institutionalize the information around the importance of water sanitation and hygiene and how they're all connected, and that you can't just have, clean water if you don't have sanitation and hygiene. You don't.
Right.
There's still risk.
Right.
Of,
it's all connected.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool.
Did Yoshi have a follow-up question for Gemma?
Oh, it looks like it. As the microphone passes over to Yoshi.
I caught one of your shows in San Francisco at a cabaret that was off of Market and enjoyed it very much.
Gemma's a singer, by the way.
Gemma's a singer, a fantastic singer. I mean, this, talk about, I'm sorry, one of the pieces that it would have been lovely to keep is the 3 hours of the one-hour interview.
Yes, that went 3 hours.
That Dean and Gemma did. The first hour was Gemma interviewing Dean.
Right.
And you opened up to her in a way that you, like, certainly didn't to your therapist. But the story about Gemma's music and how
the
much
UN.
That opened the doors for this effort to make a difference in people's lives. Was quite powerful.
Yep.
And maybe when she answers Yoshi's question, she can
answer it in song.
Pimp any website. No, any websites you might
pimp
have
any websites,
or anything.
Yeah, that's better.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Yoshi.
What I was curious about is that when we watch, most of us at least, watch the film, it's sort of through Dean's perspective on all these different subjects. And I'm wondering how it was for you to watch it as one of the sources and sort of being inside the film as opposed to outside like the rest of us are.
Well, I have to say I was nervous because, who wants to be called a conspiracy theorist?
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, I kind of am glad I am, you know, being called one.
that's nice.
In this context, anyway.
Right.
And it was...
Well, you notice we call everyone friends of truth.
Friends of... I'd much rather be called myself that.
Right.
And friends of Chilpack.
thank you.
But it was the part that I loved the most was just how you opened it up, just claiming your own, you know, your own perspective on conspiracy and questioning it all the way through. And I thought that was such a wonderful weaving through the entire movie of just like you constantly, was she a therapist? What was she?
Yeah, Dr. Nikki Monty.
Yeah,
yes.
To have her completely, you know, constantly question you and you have to, you know, having to ask yourself those questions that you probably never wanted to ask yourself as a conspiracy theorist.
Well, I actually like answering. I don't know if I always answer them. And then if I do answer them, I often forget the answer, which is also bad for therapy when you forget the answer.
I don't think you forget it. I just don't think you'd believe it anymore.
Ah. Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to write that down. Call my therapist. Any websites? Did you want to pump the web? Yeah.
Do you want me to?
Pimp the website, of course.
Okay, I'm the director of the Global Women's Water Initiative. It's www.globalwomenswater.org.
Awesome.
Yay. And music?
And my music, if you want to go on YouTube, the way I kind of started all of this stuff, as I mentioned in the movie, I was a singer-songwriter and a preschool teacher in New York City before any of this started, had no background in water, had no background in any kind of development work. And in response to September 11th, I wrote a song called We Rise. And it started out to just be sort of this personal healing song, and then it turned into this crazy notion of, you know, building a million voice choir around the world to sing it. And it just so happened that I used water as a metaphor. I mean, one of the metaphors was it takes a single drop of water to start a wave. So the invitation for people as I was going around the world asking people to sing it with me was that to really just think about their every thought and their every word and their every action as that single drop, that it will ripple out, that it will impact, and to choose, you know, to consider the world when they're doing it. And because I used that metaphor, all of a sudden I started learning about all the water crisis that was happening. And one of the places I got invited to sing was the United Nations Water for Life Conference. And it was there that I started to learn about the actual water crisis, that at the time there were 1.2 billion people, you know, who didn't have access to water, 3 to 5 million people dying of water-related disease every year. I mean, a child dying every 15 seconds, and it started to become even more relevant. And soon after, I started to be known as this water woman because I started to infuse that message into the invitation. And by September 21st, 2004, we had over 100 cities and 60 countries singing from all over the planet. And that was the day that we actually had the Million Voice Choir mobilized. And it was then that I realized, you know, well, this is a wonderful event for 7 minutes, what happens in minute eight, you know? And that's when it made sense for me to start actually focusing on water. And thank you to Queen Latifah and CoverGirl for giving me an award for women changing the world through music. And I just took that money and opened my own nonprofit and started to do water projects.
That's it.
And that's why our weekly event takes place for an hour, so that we don't get nagged by such thoughts. Right? That was an hour. I'm too tired to go and change the world through anything.
Right. I hope this podcast
back
did
to
it.
My compound.
Awesome.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes, down here. Excellent. As we
punt.
Yes, exactly.
So is it a big deal up here this end of days thing? This,
apparently not.
Were there bus ads and everything? All throughout L.A. we saw on the sides of buses about Judgment Day coming.
Yeah.
And apparently it's not.
They spend a lot of money.
It's just what Silicon Valley calls Tuesday.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In working on this movie with so many people in the paranormal community and the conspiracy community, did you have any experiences of your own? Maybe any paranormal experiences or things you can't explain?
Unfortunately, no.
While making this
film? While making it. The microphone didn't work one time, but that's not really paranormal. That's just batteries. When we went to Mount Adams, I really thought, you know, that night at the hotel, for sure we're going to see something in the sky. And I think we even got up throughout the night and looked out the window.
I love this "we" that you always use.
Oh, right, you did.
Like the same way that we will go and handle a particular question while you're drinking wine and signing autographs.
That
was very interesting, though, that issue of the when we went to Mount Adams and hoped to see UFOs, and we actually, the closer we got there, and we could kind of feel like, okay, maybe we are going to find something. We both sort of said, God, it would be the worst thing possible if we see anything.
Yeah.
Because then we'd have to use it, and then the whole, I mean, it would become the tail that wags the dog.
Yeah, it'd lopside the whole movie going, oh, look at that little spot they just planted that, you know, whatever. That it's just like, it's the tail that wags the dog, for sure.
You know, I don't know. There could have been paranormal experiences. The act of creating any project, let alone something like this, where you have hundreds of hours of footage and so many disparate personalities and disparate voices, and you're trying to weave all these in some sort of organic way, is in and of itself such a paranormal experience.
Right.
Because it is so dependent upon synchronicity as well as intuition. And the universe has to help you, for lack of a better word, and communicate to you. And that process is such alchemy that did I see any ghosts? There could have been, you know, so many things going on all around me. And I had this, I was being gifted all this wonderful material, and this was my responsibility, and this is where my focus ought to lie. We have had experiences in the past, of course. We made a film called Spectres that's a ghost story, and there were experiences that happened while we were making that film. Mm-hmm. And while we were making this film, Dean tried to get me to agree to be interviewed for a Discovery Channel piece, remember, about haunted theaters in Hollywood. Because when we had the world premiere of Spectres, or not world premiere, but an industry screening of Spectres before the world premiere, we did this on Hollywood Boulevard, the old Pacific Theater, which no longer is even operating. And on that opening night, I had made this ghost film, had never seen anything, but I had ghost chasers, I'm going to call them, that sensitives, who had been basically technical advisors. And I invited them to the screening because I just wanted to know, look, did I treat this with respect? And during the screening, this gentleman, I was so frustrated because the sound, unlike tonight, which was very good, the sound in this theater was horrible. The speakers were off, the mix was off, and it was driving me nuts. This is the first time anybody's seen this. It's driving me nuts. And at some point, while it's driving me nuts, I see this man at the end of the row, and he's trying to get my attention. He's in a suit, kind of an old cut of a suit, and a trench coat, and that seems a little strange, but he's trying to get my attention, and I'm all like, yeah, I know, the sound's horrible. Go talk to one of the producers. I'm just the director. I figure he's the owner of the theater. That's what it seems like. And he keeps trying to get my attention at the end of row of all these people. And finally, I start to go, this is bizarre. This is really strange. And so then I look down, and he's gone, finally. And I just exhale. Oh, thank God. And I lean back, visibly relieved. And one of these sensitives next to me says, what, the guy at the end of the row trying to get your attention? I said, yeah, thank God he's gone. And she says, no, he's still there. You just thought it was odd that he was there, didn't you? And so, you know, hairs go up on the back. Because you know what? You know the X-Files phrase, I want to believe, right? I don't want to see things. Honestly, I have my hands full, honestly, looking at this man and seeing him as he really is. Being able to look into the eyes of my girlfriend and try to see her in as authentic a way as possible. Trying to understand my friends. Trying to understand the just the mysteries and the wonders. Yeah, apparently I'm angering the spirit world.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't care. That occupies my time, and that is important enough a challenge for me that I don't really... Are there aliens? I don't care. I really want to understand the people that I meet, right? Mm-hmm. And so an experience like this, yeah, I started to be freaked out by it. And if I was seeing something and started to think it was odd, I probably stopped being able to see it. People did convince me, and I guess this is how you knew about it, because you were there. I went up to the manager afterwards, and I said, there was this gentleman. He was dressed like this. And they said, oh, yeah, that's so-and-so. He's been coming into work every day for 80 years since he died. And
yes.
So I never told anyone about this. After that night, I never shared it. Dean reminds me all these years later that... about this because he wants me to be a part of this show and talk about it. And I refuse. However, I do agree to do some research into it. And I find out, I look up that theater, I do a description. Sam Warner of the Warner Brothers, one of the famous Warner Brothers, was originally in charge of that theater where we were. It was being designed to house The Jazz Singer, their first sound film. He was particularly responsible for the installation of the sound system, which he could never get right. So the premiere had to take place up the street at the Chinese Theater. The stress of it and the disappointment apparently killed him, but the next Monday, everyone who worked there saw him still come into his office, and apparently every day after that. I love the fact that whatever it was that I saw, it happened while I was disturbed by the sound
right.
in Sam Warner's theater.
Right.
So that's my...
80 years later, you're still pissed off.
80 years later, I finally answer that question.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, good one.
We've
yeah,
got another question up here.
One then.
Conor Dornes. This gentleman was a production assistant on my first film.
Party Crashers.
Which I shot, no, Till Death Do Us Part. I shot it in 94 here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We reconnected this week, and here he is today.
Ah, fantastic.
Hi, Con.
Pleasure to see you guys. Again, great job, Phil, and... Pleasure to meet you, sir.
Thank
it's an
you.
Honor.
Likewise.
This was his whole job on my first film, by the way. Was to pleasure, say things yeah. like that.
Hello,
good job,
to meet
sir.
You. Well done.
Nice shot. Till death do us part. But anyway, I just wanted to comment.
Production assistants don't comment.
No, it's out of that now. Okay. Watch that. We moved on. Okay. Yeah.
Well, since I've moved on, I used to work for a major airline that was involved with September 11th.
That would be
here in San Francisco.
United?
Yes.
Good chicken. Yep.
Well, anyway, I'll just tell you a crazy story. I don't know, a lot of people might have heard this or not, but when they decided to have the funeral for the people that were lost, especially the crew here in San Francisco, a lot of people came together. I don't want to get too political, but the mayor at the time was invited by the group and to say a couple words, unlike New York. But anyway, he just refused to. And what a lot of people don't know is about a week later, the airport had a grand opening of a new store. He showed up for that grand opening.
So you just talked funeral.
And he, when someone went to ask him, in fact, I encountered him a few years later. I said, you know, we missed you at the funeral. Did you have something else? And he just shrugged his shoulders and he's like, what funeral? What? After reminding him of September 11th. But my point is that for me personally, it's still dear in my heart because it just happened. It was a day off for me. And I had some family that actually left New York 2 days prior to the incident.
Right.
And to this day, I mean, I still remember it like yesterday. But my point being is that, you know, just want to tell everybody, no matter what they say, thank God we're all here.
Yeah. You know, even Seth MacFarlane, who created Family Guy, was flying from Boston back to L.A., and he slept in. And he had a ticket for flight 11, I think. Out of a, and he ran to the airport just as the plane was backing away from the gate. And he goes, can I get on that? And he goes, no. So he goes back home, goes back to bed, misses the whole news thing, and then wakes up and he goes, oh, man, I better call the production office. And by this time, the production office thought he was on the plane. They were making contingency plans on how to redo Family Guy and keep the show going. Who are they going to bring in for the voices? They were already, like, sent out a casting notices. They were, like, all in panic. And then he calls, and they all just started cheering. And he's like, you're happy I slept in? What the hell? And he was like, and he now has that ticket framed.
Wow.
That he never, the boarding pass that he never used.
I just read that he's going to be rebooted to do a new Flintstones.
A new Flintstones. I know. How excited is that?
That brings it all back to Judgment Day.
Well, don't get me started.
Seth MacFarlane doing the Flintstones.
I told you I would be back, but not in that way.
That'll have to be our last question.
Yes.
You
have one more?
Okay.
Okay, we got...
Oh, this is
oh,
the
this
best
is the question.
Question. We have time for one more question.
We do have time for one more question.
By the way, I cut him off because, boy, the way, in the UK, we had quite the drama when Dean demanded there be one more question.
Yeah, so we want this
So this question. Is a brilliant question.
Put it on the microphone so everyone could hear it.
Yes.
How do you go about purchasing the movie with a double disc?
Ah, Phil?
DVD, the
yes.
two-disc DVD, the Blu-ray edition will all be available through the website, truth-is-out-there.com.
Yes.
We will also be touring the world, will we not, for the next couple of years. Anywhere they will have us, any size screening possible,
right.
Showing the film.
We'll come to your house.
Selling it in person. seriously, you got a beer. And friends, I've said this before in promoting this film. And seriously, thank you for asking and caring enough to ask that. And I've said this before in promoting the film that I reached a major epiphany a few years ago as a filmmaker when I was traveling around promoting another movie that I had made, and I realized that most of my life I thought I traveled around making films, promoting them, showing them, screening them, so that I could keep getting to make movies. And at some point a few years ago, I realized that that really wasn't true, that I make movies so that I will be allowed to travel around and meet people and talk to them and hear their stories like yours, Con, and get to know them and learn about places. The making the movies is just my way of singing for my supper. So hopefully I sang artfully tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you for being here. Thank you, Dean Haglund.
Thank you, Phil Ernest.
And that's another installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every installment
every
of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour
installment
at chillpackhollywood.com.
Yes, become a liker.
You can become a liker.
On Facebook.
On Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
And that's also where we'll tell you where you can get the two-disc DVD, which actually we were going to have here tonight. But a funny story about making DVDs when they don't have them properly.
It's great when, you know, the day before you're supposed to pick them all up, you get an email message. Wait, haven't you gotten all our email messages saying that the masters had failed our pre-pressing test?
Like what?
No, odd that the only email we would get from you is the one wondering whether we'd gotten all your other ones.
Yes.
And that pre-mastering test, you mean that test that's done... the day before you're supposed to deliver when you realize, uh-oh, that order fell through the cracks.
Yes, that one. So, therefore, they're not here. But, again, at Facebook, soon. You can do that. We're closing
you
down.
You can like the film.
You can like the film.
Like the film on Facebook. Facebook.com/truthmovie.
Huh?
And, seriously, we do, you know, we're self-distributing this. I know most of you know this. We're doing this ourselves. We're eschewing any help from distribution.
Screw them.
Partners. I love it. I love that. I mean, what better? We have you in the movie championing United Artists. They're going to make their own movies, be their own distribution company.
Fight the power.
And we're doing that. And, of course, the only way we can do that is if people who've seen it and like it tell their friends and share it, spread the word.
That's right. And I think we're no longer on MySpace. So we're not. We've abandoned that amusement park of the internet.
We have like a storefront there that says we'll be back in 15 minutes or whatever.
We're not.
But you said now that Arnold's maid has a MySpace profile, you want to go back to it.
Yeah, everybody's going back to MySpace because the maid has a MySpace profile but not a Facebook profile.
Okay.
Anyway,
so I think
and follow us on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Follow us on Twitter. Twitter.com/dhaglund.
And Phil Lairness, easy to spell. Just looking on the brochure, but it's spelled wrong in the brochure.
Yeah, and Kevin's this oldest friend. I mean, not that he's that old, but I mean, we've known each other the longest. And he pointed out that it's misspelled. My last name was misspelled. So I said, yeah, I'll get the guys on that right away. Of course, I'm the one that misspelled it. And I left an S off the end of my name. And the other night, I'm signing something, right? And I'm looking at my signature. I have always misspelled my name. In a signature, I've always left the S off, and now my typing is just catching up to my cursive.
Fantastic.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, everybody.
It's the Retro Dome.
Hooray! Thank you, Retro Dome.